Les conférences du Collège de France.
Nous accueillons la troisième conférence de Chiara Gasparini. Aujourd'hui, la première était consacrée à une présentation générale du sujet. La deuxième était sur les tissus, disons, iconographiquement supposés sassanides, ce qui ne veut pas dire qu'ils l'étaient du point de vue du lieu de production. Et aujourd'hui, c'est au tour de l'Empire tibétain. Alors, on dit Tibet, on dit aussi Tsinghai, parce que, comme vous savez, bon, tout ça, c'est un peu névralgique. Voilà. Mais, donc, nous allons maintenant l'écouter. Je vais en face.
Good morning, everyone. So, thank you again for inviting me here. And today is a pleasure to present a small part of my present project on the Tuyuhun Tibetan material culture, which has been supported by the Henry Luce Foundation and the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Oregon Humanities Centers, and College of Design at the University of Oregon. This project is a large work in progress that mainly focuses on textiles and metal objects discovered in Qinghai and Gansu provinces of China, beyond central Tibet, which once, however, were part of the Tibetan Empire. I am not a Tibetologist, but I became interested in this material because it is very much related to similar artifacts that I have studied for about 20 years from Central Asia and the Western region of China. I am especially interested in people who directly or indirectly helped the formation of the Tibetan Empire in the late the imperial period between the 7th and 9th centuries. In particular, the Tuyuhun, who were descendants of the Xianbei state of the Northern Steppes, who the Tibetan eventually absorbed in the 7th century, that I discussed in my first lecture here, and the Turks, from whom the Tibetan acquired some traditions and also materials such as turquoise, and with whom they were also confused in Islamic sources. So what and where was Tibet? So sources related to the rise of the Tibetans are scant and confusing. Among the most important documents written in Tibetan are the old Tibetan annals and the Tibetan chronicles discovered in Dunhuang, Gansu province of China. However, other sources, primarily Chinese and early Islamic accounts, provide further evidence of the fundamental role of the Tibetans across the border of China and Central Asia. Although officially the Tibetan Empire began in the 7th century when Son Tsengkhapa of the Yarlung dynasty unified various groups of people across the Tibet plateau and established the capital in Lhasa, Tibetan documents mention that already in the 6th century, groups of people from the Tibet plateau, at this moment not yet a cohesive confederation, had moved beyond their territories against the Hunna, possibly the Eftalites who controlled Kashmir, and against some people called in the sources Shanamas, possibly, who knows, the Sogdian or other people from Central Asia, and also people from of Khotan. People called Tupot from the Tibetan plateau are mentioned in the Orkhon inscriptions among the various groups who took part in the mourning and funeral of Bumin Kagan, the founder of the first Turkic Khaganate. In the history of the Tang, it is mentioned that in the 6th century, Tibet had an army of 100,000 warriors. In this account, Tibet is recorded under the controversial name of Tufan, but the character Fan was also read Bo, and therefore Tubo, perhaps originally referring to the Tibetan name Bod, the original, the pre-Buddhist religion of Tibet, which is mentioned in an inscription dated to 822 in the appendix, again given with the character Fan or Bo. Such characters were still used during the Sun dynasty, and eventually during the Liao period, the name changed to Tupote, eventually Islamic sources translated into Tubat, which in the West became Tibet. The area occupied by these early Tibetans, recorded in these documents as a red-faced people, is often confused in Persian and Arabic sources as inhabited by Turkic people, also called Turanians. Turan was referred to as the opposite special unit of Iran or Iran Shah. Specifically, it was that land between the Oxus River to the east and the Euphrates River to the west, as already mentioned in the Avesta, recorded in written form in the 6th century, which mentioned various tribes, among whom the Turanians. In the past, it was proposed that the Bon religion, the pre-Buddhist religion of Tibet, as I mentioned, could be linked to Zoroastrianism. In a 9th century edition of the biography of Shen Rab, the founder of the Bon religion, which was allegedly compiled in Aramaic in Elam and translated first in Chanzhong language and eventually into Tibetan, it is said that Shen Rab moved to central Tibet from Tagzig, perhaps Tajikistan, and Chanzhong, this area here northwest of central Tibet. These two were land inhabited by Iranian tribes and nomads of Iranian origin, or as it was understood, as people speaking an Iranian language. Whether or not such sources can be considered reliable historical facts, they suggest a certain level of familiarity between indigenous people from Tibet, from the Tibetan plateau, and Central Asian custom and tradition, as visible in the material, namely textile and metalwork, that combine Turk-Iranian and Chinese aesthetics. The distinction between Iran and Turan, however, is also mentioned in the Shahnameh, or Book of Kings, written by Ferdowsi in the 10th century. Initially, Turan was part of the Iranian world system, but as indicated also in Islamic sources over time, it became inhabited by non-Iranian or half-Turks who became actively involved in the Central Asian political, cultural, and religious shift, mainly including Buddhism and Zoroastrianism. As the Arab geographer Al-Makdisi mentioned, Tubat or Tibet was a land inhabited by people with the flat nose of the Turks, the brown skin of the Indian who wore garments in Chinese styles. Through his pilgrims to India, the Chinese monk Xuanzang traveled across the Himalayas and recorded the customs of Kashmir and other places, among which also some that he never visited. In the kingdom of Brahmapura, near the source of the Ganges River, he collected information about a country called Suvarnagotra, or the land of gold, west of Tibet and south of Khotan, possibly corresponding to the southern part of Zhanzhong. People from Zhanzhong acknowledged Tibetan suzerainty in 634 and together moved against the Tu Yuhun in Qinghai in 663. Several art objects remark such a connection with the Turk-Iranian culture of Central Asia, such as the 8th century silk textiles fragment featuring lobed medallions enclosing a raptor carrying a human, which recalls an early Iranian silver plate with a similar image from the region of Perm in Russia. Such a transfer was due to the expansion of the empire and the alliances with the neighboring countries, which often occurred through marriages and tributes, merchant trading, and war plundering. However, such material culture also crossed the borders through the ministers who lived and moved between and beyond the Tibetan encampment, so-called movable centers in the sources. Movable centers and ministers are the two main aspects of early Tibetan society in Qinghai, which I will discuss today. By the 9th century, the Tibetan Empire had extended from part of Sichuan to Qinghai Tibet Plateau, Xinjiang, Gansu, with the core of their empire in Tibet. According to the Tibetan document, central Tibet was divided into four parts, also referred to as the Four Horns, which were administrative units for military recruitment and governance. Overall, the land was divided into royal land and service land, considered aristocratic domains with different taxation systems. The court would move twice per year with a large encampment described as a mansion, movable center. According to the history of Tang, in Tibet, only people of rank live in large felt tents, while others lived in houses with flat roofs. Similarly, although city walls have been found in around the Qinghai Lake, we know that people live in tents outside these walls. As for Turco-Mongolic nomadic people, also for the Tibetan, the tent embodied the ruler called Spurkagan or body tent, and thus the movable center of the empire. Among the Turks and other nomadic groups, the exterior color of a tent would distinguish aristocrats from ordinary people who were referred to as white and black bonds, respectively. But possibly other colors for the exterior of tent were also used among different people. However, types of circular white tent and black trapezoidal tent are depicted in the scenes of the Tibetan wooden coffin discovery in Qinghai. Still today, people across the Qinghai-Tibet plateau use such types of tent. A white felt tent that is decorated inside with patterned textile and rugs, more similar to the Kazakh and Mongol type as this one that I took in Tashkurgan. And a trapezoidal tent made with a dark brown yak wool textile that is suspended with complex braided lashes made of yak wool as well. Unlike the format white tent, in this case, the interior is empty and includes only animal furs on the ground. During the Tang period, the Chinese were fascinated by such nomadic dwellings, which eminent people began to use in the cities, showing their taste for foreign exotic goods. The Tang poet Bo Zhuyi and Prince Gao Ming, son of the Emperor Taizong, erected Turkic tents in their courtyards. In the 9th century, the Chinese also recorded that both Tibetans and Uyghurs used such large dwellings and embellished the interior with gold animals cast in the round, which might refer to the gold or gilt plaques with animals, similar to the later Tibetan types, such as this on screen, that were used to decorate the golden tent of the Turks, as also described by the Byzantine historian Menander Protector. Two of the three types of tent belonging to Dizebul, ruler of the Western Turks, who welcomed a Byzantine envoy in the middle of the 6th century, included gold decorations. The first tent, which stood on two wheels, possibly on a large wooden cart, similar to those used already by the Northern Way, as you can see in these wall paintings from a tomb, and also later by the Mongols, who was decorated with simple silk draperies of different colors. And I have found only one tent of different colors on a Tuyuhun coffin, as you can see there, from Qinghai. The second and third tent were decorated instead with patterned silk draperies and had gold objects, so vessels, gathered at the centers, piled up at the centers. The latter was supported by columns with gilded timbers, including a gold seat with four gold peacocks as feet. A golden turquoise set of vessels, such as this one in the Altani collection here in Paris, would have been placed in a Tibetan tent at the center. As a movable center representing a body, the tent was a central part of these people's funerary ritual. Although Tibetan sources do not inform us about their funerary practices, from the excavated material we can deduce that these people combined different religions and funerary traditions, such as also covering the face of the deceased with mask or gold and turquoise decorations, or also self-laceration as a mourning practice, as the Turks did. Coffin from Qinghai elaborately displays some of these rituals. In one scene, a white tent covered with a polychrome textile is surrounded by people who are mourning a deceased person who likely lays inside. And in another scene, a man is slashing his face with a sword in front of a large tent, and behind him a banquet is taking place. In this composition, beside hunting scenes, we can also spot a couple of lovers who are generally placed at the top, far from the central scene, and might represent the rebirth or reincarnation of the deceased in the next life. The practice of self-laceration, with the which is depicted on the coffin and also appear in Mogao Cave 158, is in fact also seen among the Turks in the funerary ritual depicted on one of the marble panels of the funerary couch now in the Myo Museum in Japan, dated to the 6th century, and again among the Turks in a mourning scenes depicted in a Kizil cave painting. In the Book of Joe, completed in the 7th century, it is said that when someone of the August Turk died, the body was laid in the tent while his relatives sacrificed sheep and horses in front of it. Then they rode their horses around the tent 7 times and slashed their faces each time they came to the opposite side of the tent entrance. After this first ritual, they chose a day and burned and buried all the deceased belonging, including the tent. But after the fall of the first Turkic Khaganate in the 7th century, the funerary custom of cremation changed to burial, and the rituals of self-laceration slowly declined. The Chinese pilgrim monk Xuanzang also confirmed such funerary practices in his account. He described the Hu people as aborigines that cremated the bodies of their deceased, and their funerary practices, including slashing their faces, mutilating their ears, cutting off their hair, and rending their garment. In the following centuries, the Khitans from the northern steppes who established the Liao dynasty in China still use funerary urns in the shape of circular tent with depiction of animals on the exterior. An example is this one unearthed in Inner Mongolia. A few large pattern textile hanging and several golden objects featuring animals recently resurfaced, and they possibly are coming from Qinghai, and provide us with more information about the Tibetan movable centers. I have already published the primary results of a technical iconographic analysis of one of these textile hangings held in the Abbey Stiftung in Switzerland, which originally included a piece held in the China National Silk Museum that you see here. That is the original piece that I actually analyzed about more than 10 years ago, and that became part of the cover of my book. And as you can see there, that was my original reconstruction. Before I knew that the abaque had the full panel. But another similar hanging is held in the Pritzker Collection in Chicago. Both hanging features a single and large central floral medallion with circles, the one in the abaque, and lobes, the one in the Pritzker Collection, each enclosing one or two animals. On both hanging, at the center of the medallion, a tree of life functions as a central axis that divides the composition into two mirroring parts with two stags at its sides. However, only the one in the abaque carries an identical Denfor mirror Pahlavi, yellow Pahlavi inscription along the two borders. Professor Osamra Azaranuch is kindly deciphering the inscription, and we discussed this the other day, but for now we can read that this textile was ordered to be made for a special occasion or as a gift to someone. Pahlavi inscriptions were woven on the edges of textiles, as seen also on this narrow band with the sequence of overlap leaves excavated in Dulan, which was probably used as a diadem or a belt, mentioning the Iranian king, glorious king of kings, great miracle, life protection by the royal charisma. And this is an incomplete inscription, actually. There probably was a copy of a better one that I will show you later. We can see the same leaf motif on the roundels at the corner of the abaque panel. So it was a recurrent motif. The overall animal composition featured on this hanging might be a cosmographic diagram embodying the magic hand that, as Mario Bussagli suggested, was a single force or power to which nomadic populations subscribed, or more specifically, a further representation of the zodiac and the constellation according to the India or Indo-Iranian tradition. All the animals represented in this hanging, excluding the tigers and the ducks, feature two circles in their bodies, which can be traced back to the internal organs of the stag featuring the Pasiric carpet, as I explained in my previous lecture, and might be interpreted sometimes as the representation of the sun and the moon. However, additional and more important features are the dot and triangles in the body of the stag in the center and the elephant at the bottom. The triangle also records some of the bronze amulets collected by Giuseppe Tucci in Tibet, which according to Bussagli will represent the original truth mentioned in Tibetan mystical literature. Triangular variation associated with animals, such as the three-haired circles, also appeared in the Dunhuang caves around the 6th century. Nonetheless, in this case, the triangles, and these are just some of my hypotheses or suggestions, the triangles and the various small dots in the bodies of the stags and the elephant below might represent the summer triangle and the Milky Way as seen in northern hemisphere created by the alignment of three stars, Vega, Deneb, and Altair. The animals featured in the panel, such as ducks with the ribbon or apativia, the lions, bulls, crescent antler, elks, tigers, ibexes, and rarely also elephant, can already be found on previous and contemporary textiles. However, entire boars, not as a single boar head, and running wild asses, or Tibetan kyang, seem to be unique and specifically created for this type of textiles used by the Tibetan. And you can see the running, galloping kyang on top there. Neither lions nor elephants are native to Tibet, but they appear in early Tibetan art. In one of the earliest steles found in central Tibet, dated to the 8th century, these two animals appear together. Their combination might be due to the spreading of Buddhism. The lion was the symbol of Shakyamuni's clan, the Shakya, and the white elephant was the ultimate reincarnation of the Buddha before he was born to Queen Maya. Furthermore, the seated curly mane lion statues have also been discovered in Julan and Tibet. But the image of the elephant as depicted on the panel might have been acquired from Nepal. The closest visual references are Koivo, medieval Nepalese coins, which feature a beaded roundel enclosing an elephant. Other visual references, maybe, can be found further in the West. The overall composition of elephant trees, lions, and other animals can be traced back to the 6th century mosaic floor of the Mount Synagogue at Nirim. The remaining mosaics show similar iconographic elements. Among these are two elephants under two palm trees, and above, at the center, we can see a large menorah adjoined by two lions. Such an iconography is also comparable to the composition of a Central Asian silver dish in the National Asian Museum of Art in Washington, D.C. A sort of blossom that vaguely recalls a menorah also appear at the base of a large tree with serpentine branches on which a variety of birds are perched, sided by two ibexes in the same position like the two stags standing at the center of the textile hanging. And I have to mention that so far we don't have any menorah iconography beyond the Euphrates. So this I'm not suggesting it's a menorah, but definitely recall iconographically one. Images of trees supported by elephant continue to appear in Byzantine, Central Asia, and Spanish textiles between the 9th and 12th centuries, specifically referring to the Kabbalah tree of the Judaic tradition. But reference can also be found in Hindu tantras, particularly the Muladhara chakra, the first of seven chakras situated at the end of the spine of the human body, and considered the root, which today is symbolized by a four-petal lotus flower enclosing a triangle with a seven-trunk elephant, and the Anahata chakra, which is situated at the center of the chest, represents the earth. The second is symbolized by 12-petal lotus flower enclosing an antelope or sometimes other similar horn animals. The iconographic references suggested above do not want to imply a direct Tibetan knowledge of Indo-Judaic mystical tradition, but more a transfer and assimilation of iconographic models which circulated in the Judaic, Iranian and Indian context of Central Asia of the 8th century. They were eventually combined and acquired new meaning across the borders. As previously mentioned, the overall composition of this hanging might have also embodied the Khan or Kagan who mediated between the cosmos and the earth. The portrait of a ruler surrounded by animals at Dokhtar and Nurshivan in Nigar, Afghanistan, dated between the 6th and 7th centuries, is a comparable example that might provide further clarification regarding the zoomorphic composition of the hanging. The figure, seated on a throne with two horse prosthemas, wears a crown adorned with wings and ram horns. The halo behind him is surrounded by various animals, including two elephants at the bottom. The figure has been interpreted as the Iranian god Bahman, the supreme being Ahura Mazda, the protector of men and animals, or a Turkey ruler portrayed like an Iranian god. And Professor Greene proposed another interpretation that he sees Mitra, the god of the sun, and connects the figure of the Indian bestiary of the Karana, which is in Indian astronomy is alpha of Thiti, meaning the duration of the moon cycle as seen from the Earth. The original division of space into 12 constellations related to the zodiac was transmitted to Iran and eventually from Iran and eventually acquired in Indian and here possibly retransformed. Around the ruler portrayed in Dokhtar and Nurshivan, however, the Karana are reduced to eight animals, including the elephant at the bottom and the bull, the lion, the donkey, the ibex, and the bird, as they also appear in the zodiac on a zodiac in Tamil Nadu in India. In the Buddhist tradition, developing Kashmir, these eight animals eventually became the eight Dipkala, or guardian of the directions. The overall composition of the hanging in the abaque seems to build upon an iconographic model shared by various religious traditions across and beyond Central Asia. The central tree of life, sided by horned animals and standing on a blossom and supported by elephant, both envisioned as its root, will embody the ruler as the earth of the land, which in the case of the Tibetan was a movable center, ruled according to the cycle of the constellations in the spring-summer season and fall-winter season. But only some of the 10 animals in the circles around the central medallion correspond to the zodiac sign of Indian and Tibetan astrology. More likely, the choice was based on the familiar textile iconographic models acquired centuries early through Iranian Central Asia that fitted into the Vedic tradition of India, which also included tigers, bulls, camels, horses, and donkeys, and elephants that the Tibetan acquired across the Trans-Himalayas. Although similar to the hanging in the Abek Stiftung, the one in the Pritzker collection features a different type of medallion and a specific sequence of ram and felines. The pair of stags in front of the Tree of Life at the center of the medallion stand on the foreleg instead of the hind legs and the curly pedestal of the tree. The animals look different from the stags in the Abek hanging. They do not wear a crown and their antlers are not made with small crescents, but they wear a ribbon around their neck. Their bodies do not feature any constellation symbols except for that small roundel at the junction of the front legs, but horizontal row of pearl drops and rosette. The pearl drops that decorate the bodies of the stags appear as another innovative motif in the animal bodies. Like many other contemporary weavings, this hanging also reflects the inheritance of Iranian royal culture. Similar pearl drops and stone embellishments are visible on the robe of the Sasanian king Khosrow II in the investiture scene at Tagheb-Bustan. And a fragment in the Victoria and Albert Museum also indicate that such embellishment were eventually transformed into textile pattern. In the Victoria and Albert Museum, we see a very rare example of a blue silk samite band featuring a lozenge pattern of double bead rows and pearl drops, possibly, according to the museum description, used as a clavis of a robe which was likely made in Syria between the 4th and 7th century and eventually acquired in Egypt, where it was found along with a few other textiles of possible Sasanian origin. However, the pearl drops that decorate the stags in the Pritzker hanging are placed sideways, following the direction of the animal's bodies. The sequence of the animals in the lobes and the decoration of their bodies might suggest another interpretation of the cycles of seasonal migration, which, as previously mentioned, occur in the spring, summer, and fall, winter. This hanging does not show a diverse variety of animals, like the one in the abaq, but an alternation of rams and various felines. So we have a ram and a tiger, a ram and a lion, and so on. The choice of the ram, which traditionally is linked to the figure of Ardashir I, the founder of the Sasanian dynasty, in this case might follow an archaic nomadic model of representing the constellation. A comparable example might be the one of the four gold phalere from Wettersfelde, dated to the 4th century BCE, that, although unusual, show a sequence of ram, linex, ram, and ibex, which Gernot Winfer interpreted as a representative variant of summer, spring, autumn, and winter, respectively. Although the two hanging in the abaq and Pritzker collection are very similar and very likely used for the interior of a tent, they might have created in different workshops and different geographic areas, but both for or acquired by the inhabitant of Qinghai, as confirmed by identical trims at the bottom, which have been discovered only on textile excavated in Qinghai, including narrow hanging that might have one-sided the central one to complete the interior of a tent. And this is just to give you an idea of how a tent will look like. So we will have a central panel sided by these narrow panels and then decorated with gold plaques all around. And then at the center, we will find a pile of gold vessels. Interaction with new territories and people across and beyond the movable center were mediated by the ministers and also monks who eventually spread Buddhism. By the term minister seems broadly used in Tibetan sources. The sources mention different types of ministers. In particular, they mention the pacification ministers, such as those in charge of the borders, who were generally of Turkic origin. It is said that the demon king of Turkic origin, who was allegedly brought to Tibet from a Buddhist tribe near Yarkand in Kashgar by Padmasambhava, the legendary Indian master who introduced esoteric Buddhists to Tibet, was eventually appointed great minister in 727. In addition, a prince named Mukrit Sampov, Tajik, likely from Tokaristan, was sent to guard the frontier station of the empire. But women sent and received as brides to keep peace with other countries were also called ministers. The sources mention that Tibetan princesses were often seen as great ministers. More specifically, we found two types of women as brides. Bride givers of Tibetan origin through maternal lineage and bride receivers of foreign origin. Among the most renowned foreign brides are the two Chinese princes, Princess Wenchang and Jin Chang, sent in 641 and 712 respectively, and before them also a Nepalese prince, Princess Brikurte. But Turkic princesses also married into the Tuyuhun and Tibetan court. The term Gatung as Katun or Magan as Kagan, which are Turkic titles, are mentioned in Tibetan sources. Not only are such prime minister interaction confirmed by textual sources, and the Chinese sources give us more information about it, but also by visual and material art. The cap of a set of vessels, also including a rhyton and a flask in the Cleveland Museum of Art, carries an inscription that read, "Personal possession of the high-born princess," as suggested by Hemi Heller, and the set might have once belonged to either a Chinese or a Tibetan princess. In China, Gongzhu, or princess, was a title that could be bestowed upon any female subject of the empire. It could be modified according to her relationship or her family relationship with the emperor. The type of status was related to the Hejin, or marriage alliance system, established during the Han Dynasty. For instance, we find that the elder princess was the daughter of the emperor, but the princess alone was the daughter of a commoner, and the district princess was the daughter of a king. However, Julia Escher, who wrote about the role of princesses during the Tuyuhun period, mentioned that between the 6th and 7th centuries, there were 5 cases of marriage alliances between the Chinese and the Tuyuhun. Still, none of them was recorded as part of the Hejin system. In 663, the Tuyuhun were conquered and eventually absorbed into the Tibetan Empire. As mentioned, the Tibetan adopted a combined various custom and tradition, including the princess rank system. Therefore, objects such as the vessel in Cleveland might have been part of a princess bride's original dowry, but might also have been become part of her possession later, once she joined the Tibetan court, if she was of foreign origin. The set, in fact, also includes a rhyton, which is one of those foreign objects eventually acquired and used by the Tibetan, as we can see here on a Tibetan coffin from, again, Qinghai. According to the Tibetan documents, like the Chinese, Tibetan also used metal and stones to rank the various ministers that governed the land. In particular, belt and hair ornament inlaid with turquoise are among the most popular objects that became part of the Tibetan costume. Here you can see the list of the various minister ranks. The Tibetan documents divide the turquoise rank into large and small insignia, notably rewarded for their service and commitment. Known as the King of Stone, turquoise has a long tradition in Tibet. Larger deposits are found in Iran and China, but also in Tibet itself. Nonetheless, as discussed by Per Sors and Joachim Carson, who wrote recently an article on the topic that has not been published yet, so I have to thank them because they sent me a preprint version, the majority of turquoise was imported from abroad. Allegedly, a domestic or internal minister in service during the reign of Sun Tsengangpo is credited for bringing 7 loads of shipment of turquoise from Drugu, recognized as Turfan, at the time part of the Western Turkic Khaganate, which is the only place along the Northern Silk Road mentioned in Tibetan document as described as an hostile place. Many gold and silver objects might have been produced for the Tibetans, but also by the Tibetans in their own territories. According to the history of the Tang court received high-quality gold and silver vessels from the Tibetan. A document from Iran recorded that Tibetan craftsmen from the Nob region, a place identified between Khotan and the Kokonor region or the Qinghai Lake, were hired to make cups. They likely acquired a repoussé, an inlay technique, as well as gilding by cladding from Central Asia, probably from the Sogdian, who traded musk from Tibet and were also recorded at the Tibetan court in Lhasa. One of the most famous vessels which will confirm such a connection is the large jug in the Jogang in Lhasa, decorated with images of foreign people, possibly Sogdian, dancing and playing music, that interestingly also includes the head of a camel with a crown, or perhaps a mushroom deer, similar to the head that completed the rhyton in Cleveland. A gold stem cap with repoussé appliqué dated to the 7th century also allegedly comes from Lhasa and is attributed to the Tibetan. Here we see the representation of the culture of the time that surrounded the Tibetans. The four men portrayed on the cap are an adaptation of the idea of the four lords of the world, or four kings of the world, each in charge of a quarter of the world. Such idea, which first appeared in India, is also found in various Manichaean literature, Chinese Buddhism, Sasanian literature, and also Muslim sources. It was eventually acquired in Tibet. In the introduction to the record of the Western region, the Chinese pilgrim Xuanzang described the world as the Jambu continent, where the Buddhas manifest themselves. At the time Xuanzang was traveling to the West, the Jambu continent was instead ruled by four lords. The Lord of Elephant in the south, which was humid and hot, was inhabited by people who were devotees to studies and wore a piece of cloth across their bodies and had their hair tied into a top knot with tuft falling down their shoulder, possibly India. The Lord of Treasure in the west, full of precious goods, was inhabited by good merchants who lived in big towns. They wore short jacket, fastened on the left, cut their hair short and kept a moustache. People from Central Asia, not necessarily Sogdian. The Lord of Horses in the north, which was called Embracing, inhabited by cruel nomadic herdsmen who live in felt tents, nomadic people from the north, of course, the Turkic in this case. The Lord of Men in the east, inhabited by amiable and clever people, lived in houses with doors facing east, had a strict social hierarchical system, and a dedicated class of people devoted to commerce. They wore hats and belts and had their garment fastened to the right side. The carriages and clothes classified according to their rank and were attached to the native land and unwilling to leave it, the Chinese. Although the four kings depicted on the stem cap that I just mentioned do not precisely reflect Xuanzang's description of the four lords of the Jambu continent, they still synthesize the idea of the four corners of the world. The most famous examples of such visualization of the world is perhaps the so-called Hall of the Ambassador in Afrasiab, Sogdiana, where people of different origin, dressed in various attires from the four corners of the world, are paying homage to the local king god in the last half of the 7th century. Among these, we can perhaps identify also three Tibetans, and more specifically, people from the Tibet plateau, perhaps Zhanzhung. The images, however, of the four kings of the world were eventually standardized in the Chinese artistic Buddhist context as the four heavenly kings. But kings in early Tibetan art are generally portrayed in very specific outfit that differs significantly from any of the four lords on the stem cap. They wear a short-sleeved shirt on top a long-sleeved robe and a wing crown or a Chinese Rui mushroom crown, often in the action of hunting and banqueting. A more sophisticated version of the short-sleeved shirt, decorated with ruffle, is seen on 8th century Tibetan gilt silver vase in the Louvre Abu Dhabi. The vase shows two different hunting scenes, one on each side. Crowded with people, horned beasts, ferocious felines, monkey, mushroom deers, and guardians holding a spear, one of whom has a horned animal's head, which is very similar to the central image on a silver cap in the State Hermitage Museum, which recalls also the horn mask head, people with horn mask head in the wall painting from Panji Kent. On both sides, we see a ruler and his heir wearing identical short-sleeved shirt embellished with ruffles, loose trousers, and crowns. On one side, the crowns appear decorated with flips, vaguely recalling the wings of some Sasanian crowns, while on the other side, they are decorated with motifs that recall the Chinese Rui cloud or fungus of immortality. Such crowns were indeed in use among the people living in the western region of China, as demonstrated by an example excavated in Ningxia. Similar images of pseudo-Sassanian king wearing wing crowns also appear on textiles. An example is a piece from the Oryuji Temple in Nara, in Japan, and now in the Nara National Museum, featuring four kings hunting lions that record the scenes of the vase in Abu Dhabi. This textile, which was probably created in Turfan, would also reflect the idea of the division of the world into four parts ruled by four kings. However, in addition to this type of royal outfit, generally the Tibetans wear robes with or without lapels, also long capes and robes with very long sleeves, sometimes embellished with large cloud collars as a mark of high rank social status. They also wear trousers and boots and cover their head with turbans, conical headgear and hat with large brims. Cloak with or without fake sleeves and high-collared jacket made with textiles featuring large lobes roundle enclosing pair of animals were extremely popular. A cloak held in the Abex Stiftung, decorated with beaded arches including lions, ibexes and yaks, and was likely also embellished on the back below the neck with this golden plaque, according to the Abeg reconstruction, featuring various birds, is particularly important, not only because it carries an inscription in the seams, which suggests that it was a recycled textile turned into a cloak, but also because it confirmed the use of such textile among the ministers, as seen in the Yanli Ben painting of the Tibetan embassy at the Chinese Tang court. The inscription is unclear, but one can read something Sabug with the seal. As Brenda Dodson, who kindly deciphered the inscription, explained to me, Sabug might refer to the textile or the textile name or textile item, and probably was preceding part, which is missing, was the owner's name. The robe in the painting is trimmed with another type of red textile, also discovered in Dulan, or similar one, featuring roundels enclosing ducks. A similar example, possibly from Qinghai, also carries a Tibetan inscription that read, "Excellent silk zabug, excellent para, offered by the younger sister Krimon Pan," which apparently, according to Dodso, was a typical 8th-9th century royal Tibetan female name. Like the set in Cleveland, that this textile might have also been part of a bride dowry. And also here we see the word zabug. So this zabug is recurrent in all these Tibetan inscriptions referring to textiles. Again, a child clothing set, very popular, including a jacket, short sleeve shirt, trousers, and leggings made of silk samith featuring beaded rounding with ducks, lined with a large floral tongue blossom, likely created for a Tibetan prince in the 8th century, confirms the popular use of such textiles among the Tibetans. The duck was, as I mentioned in my previous lecture, one of those Iranian motifs originally woven in wool and adopted into silk samith weavings. A beautiful robe made with these types of silk textiles, once belonging to a Turk person, in my opinion, working for the Tibetan court, is also held in the Museum Gimé, which was, if I don't get wrong, included in the exhibition on Tajikistan a couple of years ago. The robe is made of two different textiles, one featuring a grid including rams and crowned stag, identical to the one on the big hanging textile hanging from the abeg, and one featuring roundels enclosing a pair of pheasant and falcon used for the lateral panels of the robe on the side. The one on the left also carries an inscription that read Tsarim Tsam and Po, which is difficult to interpret according to Dodson, but possibly again referring to the textile itself. And according to Dodson, we should turn the inscription 180 degrees to be read, and he called it the quadratic script of 8th century Tibetan quadratic inscription. And so I checked I studied again. I went to the Museum Gimé yesterday again, and we remeasure. And so it's long 140 centimeters, and the sleeves 125 centimeters starting from the back. That makes it very, very, very long. So it confirmed the fact that we're used among these people, in my opinion. And also, I have to mention that this type of full pattern robe are only seen in Penjikent, Afrasiab, Balalik Tepe, in the Turkic, they call it the Tibetan embassy, but I'm pretty sure that this is a Turkic minister working at the Tibetan court. What we don't see in the Tibetan picture are exactly this clothing. This is just a reconstruction of one scene from the coffin. We can find these type of textiles, but the Tibetans do not cover themselves completely with this type of pattern. These textiles were only used for the collar and parts of the boards of the robes. So my idea is that most likely these were used by Turkish minister from Tokaristan or Turfan, but in working or at the Tibetan court. So the circulation of textile and iconographic transfer across the Trans-Himalaya, and more specifically between people from the Tibet, Chinhai Plateau, and Tokaristan, is also confirmed by a group of ceramic vessels, liquid vessels, in the shape of human with red faces, like the Tibetan are described in the sources. There is a practice that most likely they acquired from the two Yuhun, dated to the same period. And among these three examples, you can find some similarity with textiles from the same period. And so we have the beads that are used for the hat. In this case, this fragment is accompanied by the same Pallavi inscription as I showed you before, but it's complete, and it also includes the word Iran and An-Iran. We have a band with a square element and a particular type of checker pattern that in this period began to appear in the bodies of the animals on textile, in this case, the duck there. So, as we can see, Iranian repertoire of images had been widely available for a long time, before the rise of the Tibetan Empire. So during the 7th and 8th centuries, however, it began to be framed by or decorated with Chinese floral and cloud or mushroom motif, which characterized the style that William Watson called the Tang International Style, or as I prefer, the Tang Cosmopolitan Style, that spread with Chinese Buddhism on textiles, metalworks, and ceramics. Floral medallion, also known as Bao Huao, floral treasure, which combined foreign Chinese motif, became popular in the 8th century. Textile with floral motif or floral engraved wine, scrolled roundels, were categorized as the Duke of Linyang patterns. According to the records of famous painting through the ages, they were created by Dou Shilun, Duke of Liyang, who lived under the Xue Tang ruler and was in charge of public work in modern-day Chengdu in Sichuan. According to the records, and I quote, the fabrics created were multicolored patterns of rare beauty that everyone in Sichuan or Shu called Duke of Liyang style this day. In the time of Emperor Gaozu and Taizong, the palace storehouse included these imperial jin fabrics. Their design contained facing pheasants, fighting rams, soaring phoenixes, and galloping unicorns, all of which were the creation of Shilun and have been transmitted down to the present. End of quote. The textile we love, floral roundel, an animal I show you today, which as I mentioned were specifically found in Qinghai and used to decorate also the coffin, might have been further variation of the Duke of Liyang patterns. No information regarding 7th and 8th century looms has survived, but a great part of the Chinese and Central Asian style textiles might have been produced in Sichuan also, which was and still is today an important textile hub that for a short period of time was partially dominated by the Tibetan. The famous Shu Jin, which became renowned later in the Song period, can be dated back to the beginning of the first millennium CE. More development, however, occurred with the rise of Turkic population in Central Asia and the Xue dynasty in China. As Zhao Feng suggested, the loom used for weaving this compound, which likely lacked a tool that equally separated the warps, might have been similar to the vertical Iranian Zilu loom, which is still used today. This loom could reach a width of 10 meters and a height of 4 meters. Using a vertical loom, the weaver could have produced floating weft on the reverse of the compound, like those that appear on many Chinai fragments, including those in the Museum Guimet. To conclude, between the 7th and 9th centuries, Qinghai had become a key region of the Tibetan Empire. A unique trade of textiles and metalwork occurred not only along the more notorious and discussed northern routes, but also along an exterior route between Qinghai Lake and Lhasa, and from there to Tokharistan or Central Asia at large, which was likely that land that was described as Turan in Islamic sources. Buddhism eventually provided Tibetan with a cosmopolitan status and an educational system. Iranian images continue to appear, but framed into very ornate composition that include Chinese rui clouds and foliage, and new animals such as rampant lion, galloping wild asses or qiang, and a type of deer with a mushroom on the head, which became a typical auspicious image across the Qinghai Tibet plateau, but also acquired new meanings. For instance, a lion seizing a mushroom deer, which records the one on the Apadan in Persepolis, surrounded by floral motif and rui clouds, appear on a Tibetan gold saddle frame. But the image is also found on a scroll dated to the 9th century from Dunhuang, during the Tibetan ruler of the area, and used to represent the debate between Buddhists, the lion, and the heretics, the bulls. Although some of the material I presented today, especially textiles, might look Central Asia, they show compositions that were possibly created, also in Sichuan perhaps, only at the Tibetan, for the Tibetans, or acquired at the Tibetan courts through the mediation of Turkic people. The Tibetan, by the 9th century, had established one of the larger empire of Eurasia, and by acquiring Turk-Iranian tradition and custom first, and eventually through Buddhism and the Tang cosmopolitan style, which does not distinguish Chinese art, but the art of China in a moment of cultural and artistic interaction with the foreign people, the Tibetan created their imperial and artistic identity. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.